Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. What makes a happy family? There is certainly more than one answer to that question. For some, it's the absence of anger. For others, it's money. For others, it's togetherness and good health and so on. Our guest on today's program is best-selling author and New York Times columnist Bruce Feiler. He's done considerable research on improving the family dynamic, what works and what doesn't. He didn't turn to therapists and family counselors for his research. Instead, he went to experts in various fields, including business, science, sports, and the military. He's established a series of strategies to promote family happiness. The result is his new book. He calls it a playbook, by the way. It is titled The Secrets of Happy Families. Now listen to this subtitle. Improve your mornings, rethink family dinner, fight smarter, go out and play, and much more. Bruce Feiler joins us from a Sirius XM studio in Washington, D.C. Bruce, so nice to have a chance to talk to you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. And you can just keep reading that subtitle. It goes on. I mean, we have like seven or eight more of those things. We actually cut it down to five.
Well, we only have an hour. I thought I'd just leave it at that. But I'm sure we'll touch on most of the subjects at hand. I think, Bruce, to begin, we probably ought to define happy in this context.
Well, it's interesting that you begin with that question, actually, because we are now about 10 years into the happiness movement, if you will, positive psychology. And one idea has emerged more than any others, and that is that happiness is based primarily on relationships. Happiness, in so many ways, is other people. And yet, the group of people that is most central to our identity and to our well-being is our family. And there's actually been surprisingly little research into what makes a family happy. One of the things, in effect, that I was trying to correct in writing this book was enough of the me happiness movement and focus more on the we, if you will, on this core family identity. And it does turn out there is a lot of thinking about this, about groups and teams and how to make it work. But most of it, as you kindly mentioned in your introduction, isn't really from the world of family studies. It's really from all these other worlds where there's all this knowledge about how to make groups and teams work more effectively. And what I've tried to do here is go out into that world, find out what they know, and more importantly, what those folks are doing with their families, and then test drive those with my own wife and kids, and then try to put together some things that we know work.
But wouldn't the definition be different from family to family with regard to their own family happiness?
Yes and no, actually. I mean, I kind of hit this head on, as you know, and we can start with what, of course, is maybe the most famous line in world literature, the opening line of Anna Karenina: "All happy families are alike, yet each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way." And when I first encountered that line back when I was a teenager, to be honest, I thought it was inane. Like, of course all happy families are alike. There's big ones, there's small ones, there's boisterous ones, there's quiet ones. Everyone can make their own formula. But actually, I've changed my mind. And I think that we have learned a lot in the last handful of years. And I actually think that Tolstoy may have been right. And while the specifics may be different for particular families or particular cultures, I actually do think that there are certain large themes that high-functioning families have in common. I, of course, list them in the book, and I think that the three are: they adapt all the time. They don't have rigid rules. They are adapting and responding to what's going on in real time. They talk a lot, and they build up a family identity. And then the last one, which may sound the most obvious, but yet may be the one as parents we often forget the most, and that is they go out and play. They make time to have positive memories, because the research shows very clearly that parents should spend less time worrying about what they do wrong, more time focusing on what they do right. If you build up positive memories, they will outweigh the negative ones, and that will create this bond that allows your family to go through the difficult times that are inevitable.
Well, how is this different from our growing up, if you will? You make a point in the book that we really have to toss a lot of the things that our parents did in raising us.
Well, I think that, first of all, if you pull the lens back to 30,000 feet, I think that there are two large massive transformations that have occurred in the American family in particular. One is, of course, you have women flooding into the workplace. That's been a change, and that's been often discussed. But the flip side of that change is far less discussed, and that is that you have men flooding into the parenting space, so that men are much more involved in parenting now by every measure that we know than they ever have been. So there's this continual renegotiation, both in the workplace and at home. And I think that one of the reasons that there is this new playbook, as you use that term, which I use in my book, and one of the reasons I think there is that playbook is because of this frustration that a lot of parents have that, in effect, the old rules no longer apply. Dad did this, mom did that, the kids did this, digital technology, all of these transformations that we know about. The old rules no longer apply, but the new rules haven't yet be written. And that's really what drove me to do this to begin with, as you know, which is I just was really frustrated. You know, and when my wife and I were dealing with our young children, after we got through the slog of diaper caddies and sippy cups, and we were like, okay, it's time to build a family culture, but how do we do it? We would call our parents, but their experience was so outdated, it was almost quaint. We would Facebook our friends, and they were just as clueless as we were. And so we said, you know, I just said, look, let me go out and see what I can. I want things that work. I mean, my wife was willing to try almost anything. She was quite game, but she said, I want to make sure real families are doing it. I don't just want theory.
But in terms of the basics, didn't our parents follow the rules about communication and about play, as you put it, and the others?
Well, let's just pick one random example, and we'll talk about family dinner. Okay, so when I was growing up, family dinner was very sacred in my family. I grew up in Savannah, Georgia, as you know. Mm-hmm. 6 o'clock, my dad could leave work at 5:30. He could come home. He and my mom would go have a drink, and that was like the sacred mom and dad time, and then we would all gather for family dinner. There is, in fact, a tremendous amount of research that family dinner is great for kids. The problem is it doesn't work in many of our lives. A third of us are not doing it. And my wife doesn't even come home from work until after 6:30. But you dig deeper into this new generation of research, and the news is very relieving for parents. It turns out there's only 10 minutes of conversation, 10 minutes in any given meal. The rest is taken up with take your elbows off the table and pass the ketchup. And research shows you can take that 10 minutes and move it to any other time of the day and still have the benefits. So can't have family dinner, have family breakfast, meet for a bedtime snack. Even one meal on the weekends can be helpful. And so you can time shift. I mean, time shift is an idea that we know from the workplace, and it can be applied here. And when you dig down, in many ways, what you talk about is much more important even than what you eat. I mean, I tell this story. I mean, I'm spending it here in the top of the hour, but this may be my single favorite thing in The Secrets of Happy Families, and that is that researchers in Emory gave kids a simple do-you-know test. Do you know where your grandparents were born, where your parents went to high school, an aunt or an uncle who had an illness or something terrible that they overcame? The kids who scored highest on this do-you-know test had a higher sense of confidence and a greater sense that they could control their lives. It was the single biggest predictor of emotional health and well-being. And as the lead researcher told me at Emory, the reason is kids have a sense that they are part of a larger narrative and they understand, and you want to spend time telling your kids both the positive memories from your family, but also the negative ones and how people overcame them. So when kids encounter their inevitable hurdles, they'll have the confidence that they can push through.
We have done so many programs on this program with regard to gathering family histories and the importance of doing that. And I can't tell you how many times we've heard people say, gee, I wish I had talked more to my mother, my father, my grandmother, grandfather about the family, because they wind up not knowing very much at all. One question I have with regard to the kids' response to this, though, and just to keep this discussion going on this point, is so often, I guess, in any generation, do kids really want to talk to their parents at all?
Well, we felt, like a lot of parents, that our kids in some ways are like Bermuda triangles is the best way I can describe it, right? Words and thoughts would go in, but they don't come out. Yeah. And one of the things that we have tried to do, and in some ways the cornerstone of this, a lot of the ideas that are in this are built around this family meeting. As you know, we have a weekly family meeting now where we discuss what's going right, what's going wrong, and we engage the kids in this conversation. And one of the things that is helpful about it, relieving about it, is that it creates the safe zone where we have access to their innermost thoughts. So, yes, that's a very common complaint, and I think that parents are partly responsible for this by kind of rushing in as they're changing clothes and checking the mail and saying, "How was school, dear?" with kind of simple yes or no questions, or when they're not actually in a place where the conversation can flourish. It's interesting. One of my favorite tips that I learned about having conversations with kids, particularly older kids, is if you're having a serious conversation about sex or drugs or money or some of these things, that in some ways it's easier. I would have totally made this mistake, but it's easier if you're not looking at them. I love this story about driving in a car. A parent was driving in a car with a kid, and a kid asks a question about some sexual term that he or she did not understand. And if I were the parent, I would have jerked the car to the side of the road, turned off, looked at my kids, and now we're going to have a serious conversation. I'm so glad you asked, and I've been waiting for these 17 points to tell you. Whereas the parent in this situation actually did the opposite, which was to turn the radio up. Okay, yeah, I'm happy to talk about that, but let's just finish this song. Almost signaling it's not that important to them, but then having the conversation later as you're driving down the road, and here's the thing, you're not looking at them in the eye. These conversations often are easier if you're loading the dishes into the dishwasher, you're folding laundry, you're in the car. Cars are good because the kids can't escape, but you're not looking at them, and somehow it's easier and less threatening, and you're signaling that you're on their side rather than just waiting for this opportunity to pounce.
And yet that's probably not something you'd want to teach your child, is to not look someone in the eye when they're having a conversation with them.
Well, it's interesting. I met this is actually not in The Secrets of Happy Families, but I met this professor at Stanford, and we were talking about this, and he was explaining to me that one of the consequences, I dare say the downsides, of all the time that kids spend on Facebook and texting and all this kind of stuff is that FaceTime is incredibly important for learning to read nonverbal communications from people. In other words, you know, you and I are talking or having dinner. We are gathering all sorts of information beyond what we're saying. But because kids are spending so much time looking in screens and in groups and actually not looking face to face, they're not developing these skills. Girls have to develop it between 8 and 12. Boys a little bit later. And his theory was, to me, this professor Cliff Nass, his theory was that that's why when kids are getting into college and in their early 20s, it's why group dating, he was saying, has become so popular, is because it's almost intrusive, a one-on-one eye contact for these kids, because they're not practicing it as much as our generation did.
You're listening to Bruce Feiler. He is the author of The Secrets of Happy Families, and that's what we're talking about. We have to take a break. We'll do that and come back and continue this conversation. And, of course, we'd like to bring you into this discussion. What do you think makes a happy family? What do you do to ensure that yours is? We hope you're able to pull that off. Bruce Feiler, our guest, 382-8255 is our number. That's 382-TALK. You can also email us at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air. You can reach us through Facebook. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation with New York Times bestselling author Bruce Feiler. He is the author of Secrets of Happy Families, the subtitle of which is Improve Your Mornings, Rethink Family Dinner, Fight Smarter, Go Out and Play, and much, much more. Bruce, a number of calls are already starting to come in, and I'll get to those in a moment. A couple of things I want to cover. And you mentioned family meetings. That is something that I guess comes after the family mission statement. Tell me what that's all about.
I spoke to Jim Collins. He's the author, as you know, of Good to Great, the defining management book of the last decade. And Jim told me something very interesting. He said that all successful human organizations have two things in common. They preserve the core, and they stimulate progress. Okay? They have a core, but they also are capable of change and adaptability. So I mentioned earlier that we have really learned a lot from this and from a lot of research that talks about the fact that families need to be able to change and adapt in real time. My favorite line of parenting comes from my friend Justin, who had 4 children in 6 years. And he said, with children, everything is a phase, even the good parts. Right? Just when our kids stop teething, they start having tantrums. Just when they stop needing our help taking a bath, they need our help dealing with online bullying. And you need a way to change and to adapt in real time, because it simply is impossible to predict everything that's going to go right or go wrong, which is why we have these morning checklists now that we change a lot. And we particularly have this family meeting where every week we're talking about what's going right and what's going wrong. And we're bringing the children into the conversation. They actually pick their own rewards and punishments, because the latest research shows that if you give kids practice with these skills, they will develop them and build up their brains and become better at making their own decisions.
How did you select?
But to address your question.
Go ahead. No.
I was going to say, to address your question, you also need a core, and you need to know what values are really important. And so Jim Collins coached us through this process, which is one of the things that people seem to be most latching onto in this book, of this idea of creating a family mission statement, of identifying what really is most important to us. Okay, you know, honesty is the best policy. Yeah, I believe that. But is that really a core value? Is that like one of the 6 or 8 things that's most important to us as a family? So we got our kids involved. We had a pajama party. We made popcorn. We got into the bed and we proceeded to discuss what really are the things that matter most. And that now hangs on our wall, because research shows that if you identify what you want to become, you're much more likely to try to achieve it. And I was really persuaded by this question that someone asked, which is, could my kids really say what's important to me? I mean, maybe they can guess it, but if I haven't really told them, if we haven't really had a conversation, is it fair for us to expect that our kids really understand what matters most?
Is this something, do you think, that has to happen with your children when the children are quite young? I mean, can you start this process when they're, let's say, 15 and 16, to pick an arbitrary age?
Yeah, I think it might look different, and we're certainly open to the idea that we might change it over time. We did it when our girls were 6, I believe, but I've spoken to a lot of families. I was going into, I mean, the research for the Secrets of Happy Families involved talking to scholars, talking to, as we've been discussing, business leaders and the Green Berets and Warren Buffett's bankers and all these kind of non-traditional family experts. But also I went into a lot of homes and met a lot of families, and I kept seeing that people were doing this. They would have a belief board or a kind of a statement or just a list of principles, and I'd see it in the kitchen or the bedroom or the hallway. And I just kept seeing it over and over again with families of with kids of all different ages. In fact, I just gave a talk last night in Boston, and a grandmother came up and said that they had done something similar at Thanksgiving with grown children and grandchildren, because that nuclear family, that sort of extended family, might have a different set of beliefs than the kind of subfamilies within it. So, yes, I think this can happen at any time, and I've seen it happen at any time.
That was another point that I wanted to raise with regard to the advice that you present in your book. Is it based primarily on the nuclear family, or does this, in fact, extend to the larger family, the relatives?
I've done both. I've tried to do both. And I think that's one of the things that when I set out working on this book that I want, I didn't want to just write a parenting book, because yes, I'm a parent, but I also have aging and ailing parents. And so I spend a considerable amount of time every day of my life dealing with aging parents. I also have grown siblings, and we have gatherings of extended families. We have difficult conversations. Is it time to put Dad in a wheelchair full time? Do we need to take the keys away from Mom? Is it time to think about moving somebody into a nursing home? These are conversations that adult siblings – actually, one of my favorite chapters in The Secrets of Happy Families is about difficult conversations and taking ideas that have worked in business. I'll just mention one, because I'm so it's been so helpful for us, and I refer to this as the law of two women.
Yes.
There was very interesting research done at Carnegie Mellon a few years ago that had people attack projects both as individuals and in a group. Finding number one, groups in fact do make better decisions than individuals, especially if the group has diverse members who have different levels of expertise. So too few cooks spoil the broth, actually, when it comes to decision making. And you want to be sure that you vote on the challenge before anybody speaks. This comes from Nobel Prize winner Daniel Kahneman in his book Thinking Fast and Slow, who says groups should vote before they have a conversation. If not, the people who speak first and loudest will have undue influence. And to this law of two women, these researchers at Carnegie Mellon found that if there was one woman in a group, she would defer to the men. But if there was at least two women in the group, they would reach consensus more quickly and be more collaborative. And this has been proven in workplaces. It's been proven on corporate boards. It's been proven on federal judge panels. So if you want to have a better conversation we're talking not about kids, but among extended family members, have at least two women, the conversation will go better.
Well, we have 20 women in the U.S. Senate now. Let's wait and see how all that turns out. If there's ever a place where they need to have a little more consensus, that
exactly.
would be it, wouldn't it? Yeah. We have a number of callers. I have many questions, but I don't want to get the callers into the program. Bruce, let's begin with Jana, our first caller from Wentzville. Go ahead.
Hello, Bruce. I'm so glad that you brought up this topic and that you've done extensive writing and research on it. I'm 61 years old. I come from a very happy family, and the longer I live, the more I realize just how fortunate I am. I jotted down 7 points that I believe made our family happy. They're not very scholarly, but I know they worked. Number one is love. My mother and dad, still alive, love each other very much. And my sister and I love each other very much. And number two is fighting. I'm in counseling right now because, unfortunately, I went through an abusive marriage. But my counselor told me that my family was very healthy because we fought openly and fairly. There was a lot of yelling, but we resolved our arguments. Fighting didn't occur like in the back rooms or bedrooms. We all argued until the situation was resolved. The third point that I think is important, at least for our family, is faith with openness. We're a Catholic family, but my parents made very sure that, and they didn't do this deliberately, they had friends of many different faiths, and we visited other churches, and we openly discussed other faiths.
Jana, let me ask you, please, to kind of speed up these various points. We have a number of people waiting.
Okay. Number four is fairness and discipline. When my parents made a mistake, they always apologized to us.
Next. Go ahead.
Yeah. Number five is communication. Family dinners were not just how was school today, that sort of thing.
Got it. Let's go to the next one, Jana. We need to speed through it.
Okay. Number six is time together, making memories, happy vacations. And number six is social life, expanding the family to friends and having lots and lots of parties.
All right, Jana, we've got it. Thank you so much for these points. Bruce, you're not going to quarrel with any of them. I recognize them from your book.
Yeah, a lot of them are there. First of all, thank you for your call and your kind words. And I want to just pick out two that I think are very on the research, and the research backs this up a lot. And one is the fighting. All families have conflict, and successful families are able to manage that conflict. I went because my wife and I were having what I called the 7:42 fight. Our kids had an early bedtime at that time, and we would get together, and that's where we would discuss who's dropping off the dry cleaning? Who's picking up the shin guards? And every night we would just be at loggerheads. And I went and took a 3-day course from the folks at the Harvard Negotiation Project, thinking they deal with Israeli-Palestinian peace talks or Northern Irish. And it's like, maybe they can help me resolve these fights. And we now use a kind of watered down version of what they do with our kids. And the first thing that we do with my wife, and I'm jumping around here a bit, is we moved where we fight. The research shows that 6 to 8 is the most conflict tense rich time in a family. Everyone needs to have time to eat and change their clothes and have some private time before you come together. We also changed where we sit. because my wife and I would have these fights. I'd be at my desk. I'd be higher than my computer equipment. She was in this old IKEA chair that was a foot lower. I was in the power position, and that turns out to be an awful place to do it because she was very resentful. We now sit either in our living room, or if we're having a really tense conversation, we actually do it on this window seat, because research shows if you're sitting across from someone, you're more likely to be confrontational. Alongside of them, you're more likely to be collaborative. Now, here's a simple idea. It's like out there in business, this is how they design offices now. It's been isolated from families. And so part of what I'm trying to do here is flood these new ideas into families, take some of these things, as we've just heard from the caller, that maybe people were doing instinctually and saying, you know what? There is cutting edge knowledge about this. If parents do it, these are small things. When we did our kids, we went through their first semester report cards the other day. We sat side by side as if to physically say, we're on your side. But guess what? There's still some things you need to work on.
So there's really a science to some of this, I gather, from all the research and some of the things that you're citing.
There is, and it's just we have to break parents out of this straitjacket that the only ideas they can implement with their children come from shrinks or counselors or other family experts, because a lot of these ideas are in these other worlds and we have to bring them in. And my kind of, in some ways, my main point in The Secrets of Happy Families is we have our jobs, we work on those. We have our hobbies, we work on those. We have our bodies, we work on those. We have our families. We know they're incredibly important to our identity, but we spend precious little time actually working on them. And you can take small steps and do things to make your family happier.
Let's take another call. This one will be from Tom, calling from Webster Groves. Tom, thanks for waiting, and go ahead.
Thank you. I, by way of background, my doctorate's in marriage and family therapy, and I studied the happy professional marriage. And so on the one hand, I would love to know if on the other side of this show, if I could get your contact information, because I would love to collaborate with you. And I find you're reaching out beyond the marriage and family therapy literature to get other insights to be fascinating. So that's one question. And then the question you could answer on air for me would be, I'm also a dad with teenagers, and your idea of the weekly family meeting, we do that probably quarterly, but to do it weekly, any ideas about how to address the pushback that teenagers are inevitably going to give and to sell them on this idea on a weekly basis?
Oh, well, first of all, thank you for your call. And let me just say at the outset, I have a website, brucefeiler.com, F-E-I-L-E-R. You can email, anybody can email me directly through there. I answer every email, so I'm happy to hear from you or anybody else. Of course, all these ideas are laid out in The Secrets of Happy Families. But let me talk about this teenager issue, because it does come up a lot. And I want to say that the system that we have put into place is modeled on an idea called Agile, which is sweeping through business these days. And the idea is, in the old days, projects were done, you would have a 2-year-long project. Like an executive would issue an order, and people down below would scurry to follow it. They'd bring the project back 6 months, a year, 2 years later, and 83% of projects in the software space where this began were over budget, bloated, and late. And they wanted to come up with a system where you could make adjustments in real time. So rather than saying, go off and design me a cell phone and come back in 2 years, you would say, go design me an element and come back in a week. Let's see how it's going. Let's react. Let's adapt. In effect, you succeed or fail in real time. And that's what we're talking about bringing into families. Nothing is top down like it used to be anymore. Not government, not business, not religion, and increasingly not the family either. So in terms of selling it to your children, the main message is this is not an authoritarian system. And by the way, as you know far better than I, because my children are younger, authoritarianism simply doesn't work with teenagers. You say, we are going to basically take the best ideas from wherever they come. Parents are still going to be involved and guiding, but we're going to bring you into the process. As I said earlier, we're going to let you get involved in picking your own rewards and punishments so you become more self-motivated. You simply can't raise kids and get them to 18 and say, okay, go off and make decisions if they've never practiced making their own decisions. So the main message to kids is, we're going to find a way. Going to be, we do ours 20 minutes a week. They're going to be in short chunks, and we're going to constantly adapt. This week you got a lot of stress going on with a big test? Fine. We're going to shift around your chores so another sibling or parent takes it over. Next week, mom or dad has a business trip. We need you to step up and help make dinner on Tuesday nights. So you're constantly reacting to what's really going on around you, and you're bringing your kids more into the process. And I think that's the big message.
Bruce, give Tom that website one more time if you would, to be sure that he gets it.
Thank you. It's brucefeiler.com. So it's www.bruce, B-R-U-C-E, Feiler, that's F like in Frank, E-I-L-E-R, brucefeiler.com. There's an easy way to email me. And, of course, a lot of these ideas are gathered there, and people are welcome to stop by.
And Tom, I'll tell you and the rest of our listeners that Bruce is going to be appearing at the St. Louis Jewish Book Festival on Tuesday, March the 5th. So you'd have an opportunity there to meet him in person. That's going to be at the JCC Steinberg Family Complex again. That's March 5th as part of the Jewish Book Festival. Back to the phones. Let's talk to Al in Ellisville. Go ahead. Al, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning to you and your guest.
Hi.
I thought I was going to have a lot of disagreement with your guest, but I think I kind of agree with him. Although I may add, you probably need to write a book about each chapter of a child's life, because as they become teenagers, you pointed out that they go through tremendous changes. But when they become young adults, they go through even more, and they really fight for their independence, even though you may have, which we have, we did, teach them to be independent. They push against you, fighting for that independence, and you're constantly having to rewrite a book to deal with them, right into adulthood. And I say 25, they're still children in my eyes.
Okay, Al, thanks for the call. What do you think, Bruce? You ready for another book?
Yeah, well, I'm certainly see the pushback. And of course, what we want is our children to be independent. What we want is for them to have the skills. Let's just talk about money. I'll tell one story here. I went to see, like a lot of parents, we were struggling with how to teach our kids about money. And I went to Warren Buffett's bankers, to these guys around Warren Buffett. And I said, well, you guys deal with the richest people, families in America. You must know a lot. And in fact, I went to see this gentleman, Byron Trott, who's from Missouri, actually. And he was saying to me, well, actually, I deal with the richest families and they're worse. And his advice, it's one of the things people have most responded to in this book, was surprising to me. Well, first of all, he said, show them the money. You know, 80% of high school, college kids get to college without ever having had a conversation about money with their parents. They don't understand debt. They don't understand where money comes from, where it goes, how to make it, save it, spend it, earn it.
They understand how to ask for it.
But exactly. But the point he was making to me was, you need to give your kids practice in making these decisions. In fact, he chided me. My kids were 6 at the time, and I had done all this research, and we had divided allowance into 4 pots: spend, save, give away, and share, which is the family has to make a decision together about how to spend the money. And we don't leak money with chores. Sorry, you get an allowance, but chores are just things you have to do. Someone's got to clear the table and fold the laundry, and you're part of the system. You just got to do it. But he was chiding me because we would tell our kids how to divide their money in these pots. And I said, well, what if they make a mistake? What if they want to buy something? Or what if they burn through their money? Or what if they drive into a ditch? And he said, it's one of my favorite lines in the entire book. He said, it's much better to drive into a ditch with a $6 allowance than a $60,000 a year salary or a $6 million inheritance. And that is just inherently true. And the point is, we want our kids to be independent. Yeah, it's a struggle with us on the way to get there, but we have to give them practice developing the skills to get there. And the research, the most cutting-edge research, reinforces this idea. Kids who plan their own schedules, set their own goals, evaluate their own work. They're literally, Don, they're building up their prefrontal cortex, and they are having the skills to take control over their lives. We must give our kids the practice doing what we want them to do later in life.
That makes so much sense. I have to take another break, Bruce Feiler. Hey, we will do that now, and I'll tell folks who are waiting online, we'll be right back to take your calls. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back to our conversation with New York Times bestselling author Bruce Feiler. His latest book, The Secrets of Happy Families, that's what we're talking about. Let's go right to the phones. We have a number of folks who have been waiting a long time. Terry in Manchester is one of them. Terry, thanks for being so patient.
Oh, thank you. I'm so glad that you're having this show today. I have a couple of things to add about talking and kids. And I had five children, four of which are boys. My daughter, I could address her directly and ask her a question, and we could have a conversation. What I found with my boys, though, was that if I put doodle supplies at the kitchen table, or again, as your guest said, if I was busy making dinner or filling the dishwasher, that was when they were wanting to talk to me, when I wasn't looking at them. And we had the best conversations with them doodling at the kitchen table, and they really weren't aware that we were having a conversation. Also, if I knew that something was really troubling them, then I would take them for a ride in the car just to run errands. And with them in the back seat, they would then talk to me and ask, you know, the hard questions, et cetera. And also with my teenagers, I found they didn't want to talk until 10, 11 o'clock at night. And I always made a point to have those conversations with them, even if we ended up being awake at 1 o'clock in the morning. And I found that by doing that, when they became young adults, they would come to me and talk to me because it wasn't scary anymore.
Terry, thank you so much for the call. Boo, she really helps make your point, doesn't she?
Well, it was just beautifully expressed, and I think a couple of things jump out at me. First of all, your adaptability, your willingness to do it on their terms in their way. And I think that that is such a key lesson, which is that as parents, we kind of make ourselves invincible and build ourselves up as if we know all the answers, but we don't know all the answers. And a lot of what I'm saying to parents is it's okay to basically admit that and be reacting in real time. And as for the talking component, it is, to reiterate what I said earlier, one of the three big themes that I did encounter time and again, that families, successful, high-functioning families, they adapt all the time, they talk a lot, and they go out and play. And the thing about the talk is, I went to see, there's one of my favorite chapters in this book, it's called Lessons from the Sex Mom. And I went up to Connecticut and hung out with this mom who has a reputation in this small town in Connecticut of being the one who talks about when girls have their periods and talking honestly with boys and girls about sexuality, which is something that I found very difficult as a parent. And what was so interesting is that talking to those kids, and I sat with a bunch of teenagers of this girl swim team, and the most vivid thing that happened was this 15-year-old said to me, when my mom and dad start talking to me about sex, I put my fingers in my ear, in my ears, and then I pull them halfway out because I don't want them to know that I'm listening, but actually I'm so relieved that they're using the actual terms and giving me the factual information. Because when my friends say things, it's too embarrassing to say I don't know what that is. And on the internet, of course, there's so much misinformation. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's the greatest image of all. Fingers halfway, fingers in the ear, but then pulled halfway out, which is why, as the caller was saying, in a car, taking a walk, indirectly, at a time of the child's own choosing, you can have these conversations, it'll be much more successful.
You know, you mentioned the internet, and I just wonder what role social media can play in all of the kinds of things that we're talking about here, even in terms of communicating, because people can be in the same house now and communicate through email rather than walking into the next room to actually talk.
I'm personally a big believer that technology is neutral and that technology has a lot of negative consequences, but it also has an equal number of positive consequences, which is to say, yes, people are taking texts at inappropriate times, and yes, people are on devices, but also grandparents can Skype with children. A mom or dad at work can check in with a child at sports practice and monitor. That there are advantages as well as disadvantages. The key is to not to let the technology drive the schedule. And as this mom of five just said in that beautiful call, to find find time, back to what I said earlier about there being 10 minutes of connection time at every meal, as long as you're having these chunks of time, and they don't have to be two-hour meaningful walks, or we're going to bake the greatest pie, or clean up the garage together. It can be 10, 15, 20-minute chunks. It will make the connection so that when there is the inevitable conflict, or you're pushing your kids, study hard, clean up the room, we got to get out the door to school, the bond is there that is strong enough to sort of push through when there is the inevitable friction.
We have another caller that may want to pick up on a point that Terry was just alluding to. Phyllis in Maplewood, go ahead. It's your turn.
I was excited by what you said about eye contact. And I was a speech and drama teacher for many years. Now I've been retired. And what I'm learning from this show is the new research. There's always been communication research, but there's new research, which is really thrilling because it's helping us learn about this new era. And I've seen it in religious experiences around the world and many other areas that the rules are different now. We're in a new era. And I was so excited when I called because that point about making eye contact was something that, you know, I taught speech classes for years about making eye contact, and in a peer partners class we taught this to help people open up. But then I watched this movie, Lincoln, and Daniel Day-Lewis was so brilliant because here's the great communicator, and he'd sit kind of hunched over and kind of nod, but he wouldn't listen to these people telling him all this humma-humma stuff. And when he asked, everybody thought, oh, he's my best friend, he agrees with me, he kept his mouth shut, and he listened, but he didn't look in the eye. And so I was starting to think about that myself, and I'm just thrilled to know about this book and the new research. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you. What a lovely call. And we do know more, and it's possible to say that we have new knowledge. And the last couple of phone calls have made me think of this thing that really is one of the big things that I've learned in the course of working on The Secrets of Happy Families. And that is, when I was growing up in Georgia in the 60s and 70s, I was told, in some ways we were told in school, in some way the big message of Western civilization was that it's the lone individual and that's what drives society. But we have learned, and almost all the research does point to a contradiction to that, which is that we are wired to be in groups. We are made to be in networks. Why is the internet so kind of clicking with humanity? Because we instantly, inherently, instinctually like to be in webs and groups. When we were evolving on the plains of Africa so many hundreds of thousands of years ago, we were in these large extended families. We know that the more grandparents are involved in families, for example, the more children they have and the higher that sense of well-being. So all this evidence points to the fact that we want to be in groups, and the group that's most important to us is our family. And in some ways, my big message here is that we can make it better. You don't need a grand plan. You don't need a big scheme. You just need to take small steps, accumulate small wins. But you can, in fact, improve your lives by understanding we are all in these human networks and we can make them better.
Bruce, we're all familiar with the term, the family that prays together stays together. What's the role of religion in all of this?
I made a vow to myself when I started working on this book that I would confront truths, however uncomfortable that they were. And one is a persistent correlation in 50 years of research that the correlation is between families that have a high degree of religiosity and families that report a high degree of well-being and functioning. So we know that there is a connection. We don't know that there's a causality, so we don't know that religion necessarily causes happiness. But the latest thinking suggests, and it's been consistent over time, but it has been advanced in recent years, that it doesn't matter what belief system you have. It is not correlated to a number of religious services you attend. It's not even correlated to a belief in God What the latest research shows is that people who are in religious communities have a higher sense of community. The magic number from this research at Harvard that's in my book is 10 people. If you were in a group, if you belong to a religious institution and you know at least 10 people, you will have a connection to that religious organization and you'll be happier. So actually that list that we heard earlier that mentioned religiosity, but with openness, that to me captures it well. You want to make sure, if possible, that your children have and your family has a strong moral code, but the details of that moral code are less important than the fact that you have one.
Let's try to get as many calls in as we can. In the time remaining, we'll go to Charles in Chesterfield, who's waited a long time. Go ahead, Charles.
Howdy. Quick refinement, which is also a caution, and that is from bad parents, one learns much of what not to do, but little of what to do, and vice versa. From good parents, one learns much of what to do and little of what not to do. And the caution occurs, is shown in the military. I noticed that the guys from the happy families, so-called, were less cautious about listening to certain authority figures. And so, thank you, thank you.
Quick word about the military. They have done a tremendous amount of work. In some ways, the organization in America that's doing most to focus on high-functioning families right now is the U.S. military, because we're in a volunteer army and because of the people going into service in extreme circumstances in the Middle East, they were seeing a lot of stress. And they've done a lot of work. I actually went to meet the guys in the military at the Naval Academy who work for the Pentagon studying how to build group identity. Unit cohesion is the military term. And the last chapter of my book is called The Green Beret Guide to a Perfect Reunion, and it was taking ideas that they have developed about dividing into teams, telling history, using different generations. Sense-making is the sociological term about building an identity through history and work together. And a lot of their work really does apply, particularly to extended families when you've got grandparents and kids and siblings and cousins getting together. Everyone's got different instincts, exactly like imagine people coming from into a draft environment. And the military actually has a lot of cutting-edge thinking, some of which I've tried to put in the book.
Yeah. Back to the phones. And Tim in St. Louis, go ahead, please.
Thanks. It's just so great to talk to Bruce. You're one of my favorite writers. When I heard you were on, I had to pull over and pull into a parking lot. I just wanted to confirm
Oh,
you're welcome. I wanted to confirm what you're saying by telling you a quick story about my son who's now in college, and I recently went to visit him, and I had the following conversation with him. I said, you know, we don't talk to you all the time. You know, we don't talk to you every day. We don't email you every day. And I just want to tell you that that doesn't mean that we don't love you, it means that we think that we trust you and that you're independent and that we think that you're doing fine and that you can handle your life and that you're doing very well. And he listened to this and he said, Dad, I understand, you know, the way you handle this is very good because, you know, most of my friends, frankly, hover over their over them and it drives them crazy. But you're one of the few parents that don't do that. And I really appreciate it. And you've always had this kind of relationship with me that I really appreciate, that, you know, you trust me. And it's been like a trust relationship. And I was sitting there listening to it, and I was in heaven. So I just wanted to pass it along.
What a beautiful story. Thank you for your kind words about my work. And I just will say, my instincts as a person are probably toward the hovering. I think that I have some helicoptering tendencies, like of the helicopter parent. But one of the big things that I have learned from this process is exactly what you just described, which is in some ways the true test of parenting is when we're not around our children. When I'm around them, I can elbow them, I can force them, I can bribe them, I can threaten them, I can cajole them to get them to do what I want them to do. Briefly. But the true test is when I'm not around. And I think that that's why so much of what we have been trying to adapt in our family is bringing our kids into the process, enlisting them whenever possible into a conversation, into an experiment where we're trying things in real time. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. But the buzzword in business these days is co-creating. And that, in effect, is what we're trying to do. We're trying to co-create our family. And that means experimenting. That means everything doesn't go right. But we've basically said we're going to spend a little bit of time every week talking about this thing, our family, that's central to us, that we just always assume is there. But we've decided we can't just trust in it anymore. We have to work at it.
Can you tell us in 30 seconds what the biggest impediment to family happiness might be?
The biggest impediment to family happiness is doing nothing. Almost anyone who's looked at great organizations have discovered the same thing. Greatness is not a matter of circumstance. It's a matter of choice. So take that first step. Experiment. Don't believe you have to have everything right. But if you accumulate small wins, you can make your family happier.
That is Bruce Feiler. He is the author of The Secrets of Happy Families. Bruce, it's been a great pleasure talking with you today. And I know the audience enjoyed it. A lot of calls and a lot of interest in what you've written about. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Don.
Bruce will be appearing at the St. Louis Jewish Book Festival on Tuesday, March 5th. We have information on our website, stlpublicradio.org. Thanks again to Bruce Feiler. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about the importance of early diagnosis of autism and efforts to provide earlier diagnosis in African Americans who typically are diagnosed much later than whites. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.